It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you very much for joining me this morning and hope you enjoy the show. I'm going to start off with a little bit of a look in time. And that is, about 30 years ago or so, I was president of something called the North American Wildlife Foundation. And the first week in August of each year, the Fish and Wildlife Service would release its much-anticipated waterfowl production report and its fall flight summary. And this was the event of the year in the conservation community and certainly in the waterfowling world, as it indicated, it gave people the information for how many birds would be flying south, what kind of a year it had been, and the breeding grounds, and what to expect for the fall. And I can remember sitting in my office waiting for a phone call from a contact of the Fish and Wildlife Service to say that the report was about to be released on the wire. And I would then have, within seconds of that report, I would have John Huzar, the Chicago Tribune, on the phone, giving him the information and telling him what it meant. And it was a big deal. And the next day in the newspaper, it was always released on a Friday. And so the Sunday newspapers across the country would carry the waterfowl survey and status report. And it was the most anticipated event, as I said, really in the waterfowl world for the year. So go forward 30 years to today. It's not a very exciting moment. Nobody seems to care. Very few people, at least. There are not going to be newspaper reporters or outdoor editors such as John Huzar hanging by the phone with the typewriter ready to go and provide an analysis of the report. It's buried in a release by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and it no longer is provided by the first Friday in August. It kind of dribbles out, such as this dribbled out this week. So what this tells us in part is what is happening, I think, in the outdoor community, and in particular a community I've been close to for a long time, and any of you who are duck and goose hunters or interested in waterfowl are aware of. We are rapidly losing two things. We are rapidly losing the number of people who care about this, the number of people who actually hunt, and also something's happened over these past 30 years. The Fish and Wildlife Service has lost an enormous amount of credibility in its reports, because year after year after year, the Fish and Wildlife Service has reported that the population of ducks is strong, the population of geese is strong, hunting will be good. And yet across this time frame of 30 years, and the reports, by the way, have been going out since 1955, and the survey method is the exact same today as it was in 1955. So if it was inaccurate to begin with, it's inaccurate today, but it should be equally inaccurate. The only difference is now computers generate all these numbers based upon information coming in. So as one highly esteemed scientist said to me, garbage in, garbage out. And I think that I'm not demeaning the survey. It's the most professional survey done in the history of the world of any species. It's absolutely fantastic, but it's not absolute. And so when people look at numbers, they have expectations of the coming hunting seasons. It's a natural thing. If it's a survey on the number of deer, and they say the number of deer fawns has been increasing over the last few years, you're going to expect to see more deer. They say the number of ducks has been increasing, you're going to expect to see more ducks. But what is happening is hunters are not. And the number of hunters, as is well now statistically documented, of waterfowl hunters, continues to decline. So the surveys, which were a big, big event, are now basically just something the Fish and Wildlife Services release, and they get reported over the internet. And there's lots of analysis, but not the way it used to be. And so I think it points out how we're changing, and in part how the Fish and Wildlife Service over the years has really not been able to adapt to understand really what the people who rely on those reports, hunters, are looking for. And in particular, what's happened, and this is where I want to end up before the break, because I think this is absolutely critical. In the 1950s and early 60s, when they issued these reports, the number one duck species was a mallard. It's still the number one duck species. The number two duck species was a pintail. The pintail now is only 20% of its population of a generation ago. The number three duck species was scaup. The scaup is a third of the population it was a generation ago. Instead, the species have kind of been turned upside down, where the populations that our forefathers hunted were primarily made up of mallards, pintails, scaup, and two generations ago, canvasbacks. Today, the populations are largely now comprised of blue-winged teal, shovelers, and the mallard is still the number one duck, but it is not as populous as it was, obviously. But the increase in other species that are not targeted so much by hunters has really skewed the way that the population dynamics are reported. Very few people are getting up in the middle of the night, spending thousands of dollars, driving hundreds of miles to go shoot shovelers. It just isn't happening. People got up in the middle of the night and spent money and created hunting clubs around shooting mallards, pintail, canvasback, and scaup. Three of those four species are in dire straits. And the pintail, which was over 10 million breeding pairs in the 1950s, is down to just 2.3 million breeding pairs this year, near its all-time low again. So at a time when we are told that the populations are holding steady and that birds are actually doing pretty well, the key species that have driven the interest in waterfowl hunting since the beginning of conservation, with one exception, are doing terribly. So the Fish and Wildlife Service has lost focus that really what's happening is, while the total population, according to their numbers, is about the same, the population of birds that people hunt are dramatically down. And blue-winged teal, which are the earliest of migrants, very seldom hunted. We have special teal seasons for them, but they are gone by the time the regular duck season starts, are really not even part of the survey because they're gone before the hunting season even starts, and yet they are among the most populous duck. And the northern shoveler is also among the most populous duck now, and it's a duck that hardly anyone ever hunts, and they'll only shoot them if there aren't any other ducks around. In fact, in this year's survey, the blue-winged teal of the top species of birds was the second most populous duck behind the mallard. So we are seeing, and I don't want to get technical, but we are seeing the service not understanding that the numbers of ducks they're counting do not match up with the types of ducks hunters want to hunt. And the types of ducks hunters want to hunt are in serious, serious trouble. So the other thing I want to say just before we leave is that the Canadian prairies have gone into a serious drought. Saskatchewan and Alberta are very, very dry. Southwestern Manitoba is very dry. These are the key breeding regions for waterfowl. This year, we had an unbelievably wet year in South Dakota and North Dakota, which caused a number of birds, particularly blue-winged teal and shovelers, to settle into that area. But the Canadian prairies, which are the heartbeat of the production of wetland-dependent birds and waterfowl, are in the midst of a growing drought. So this year's numbers are not great. If the drought does not change, next year's numbers will be bleak. But more than anything else, the population of species has flipped over the years to where we are now having high numbers or higher numbers of species that people don't hunt and lower numbers of species that people hunt. So that's the summary on the waterfowl breeding survey. But coming back to the beginning, 30 years ago, this was a front page news event in the Chicago Tribune, the sports section. You'd open it up and John Huzar would have the report. Today, you can't find it anywhere. It just goes to show you how times are changing, and maybe not for the better. When I come back, I want to talk a bit about the Amazon, which, of course, is on the front page and on the televisions around the world, and offer a little bit of a perspective as to what's going on there that may not be reported. So thank you so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
In the field, hunters need to be alert, sense the environment around them, and know exactly where they are, communicate seamlessly with their dogs. And when it comes to pickup trucks, you want the same qualities. The all-new Chevy Silverado comes with an available 4G Wi-Fi hotspot for seamless communication. It's designed to handle the toughest loads with advanced trailering technology, tough on the road and off. And the all-new design gives you more cargo space than the competition. Chevy Silverado is the most dependable, longest-lasting, full-size pickup on the road. Plus, there's never been a better time to see your local Chevy dealer about the Big Fix lease. It's an amazing lease deal that can lower your monthly payments and give you more Chevy, all for less money. That's a treasure hunt. So head to your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and see why Chevy is the number one best-selling brand in Chicagoland, now 8 years running.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And I usually don't cover items that are on the front pages of newspapers or on the lead items on television news, because I think you can get that information elsewhere. And I cover things on the Great Outdoors Show that may be missed by the mass media when it comes to conservation. However, I'm going to talk about the Amazon for a moment, but I'm going to talk about it from a different perspective, and one that I hope will at least shed some light and maybe resonate as to why this is taking place. On the surface, the media is reporting this enormous increase. They're saying it's between 80 and 90% increase in the number of fires in the Amazon this year over previous years. They're talking about the president of Brazil and how he has said, you know, this is our country. We'll do what we want with our country. And he told Chancellor Merkel of Germany to go plant some more trees in Germany if she was concerned about climate change. This is missing the whole picture. The whole picture is this, in my view. There are areas of the world that are of critical importance to the overall environment of the world. The Amazon is one of those. The North American prairies are a second. We have world treasures that actually affect not only the climate of the world, but also the birds and animals of the world. The Amazon being the biggest, and North America's prairies actually being the second largest. And many of you are saying, well, what are we talking about with North America's prairies? I'll get there in a second and why this is related to the Amazon. So Brazil controls most of the Amazon. It's theirs. However, what happens in the Amazon, due to the amount of oxygen created by the trees in the Amazon, appears to be of importance to the entire world. It's estimated that 20% of the oxygen in the world is produced in the Amazon. I don't know what would happen if we lost half of that oxygen. I have no idea. We wouldn't have as much oxygen. What that would mean to mankind, I don't know. But if the world is so concerned about the Amazon, which it should be, then the world has to help Brazil protect the Amazon and to provide an economic incentive for keeping the Amazon. Just as in North America, the North American prairies provide up to 80% of the bird life for the North American continent. And it is where the aquifers are recharged. If I talk about the prairies, I'm really starting in Iowa, and I'm moving up through western Minnesota, into the Dakotas, eastern Montana, and all across the southern provinces of Prairie Canada. It's an area that's over 300,000 square miles in size. It's enormous, 92 million acres. And it is the cradle of water and the cradle of bird life for North America. And yet we expect individual farmers to save the wetlands and the potholes on their property for the benefit of society without providing them any economic incentive to do so. We expect farmers to maintain the grass on their ranches and farms because that sequesters carbon and provides nesting habitat. without providing them an economic incentive to do so. So the landowner in northern Iowa or the landowner in South Dakota or in Manitoba sits around his kitchen table or her kitchen table and says, how do we make ends meet? And that pothole out there costs me X amount a year. I pay taxes on it. I got a farm around it. I'd be much better draining it. Or that section of grass that's been there since the beginning of time, which I never farmed, I can't afford to leave that section of grass anymore because I need that income from corn on that, which I now can grow, which I couldn't grow years ago because of crops wouldn't let it. So we are losing North America's prairies at a rapid rate because of economics. The Amazon is being destroyed before our very eyes for the same reason. It's economics. The people of Brazil are trying to build a country, or in fact, many of them just trying to survive. The president of Brazil comes in and says, I want our country to be stronger. We have this incredible resource in the Amazon. We're going to burn down millions of acres of trees. We're going to turn it into farmland so we can be more prosperous. We can help feed the world. And the world says, no, you can't do that. That's terrible. But the world is not willing to pay Brazil not to do that anymore. And someone in Houston, Texas, is willing to pay a farmer in North Dakota not to plow up the prairie, or we are not willing to pay a Canadian farmer not to drain their wetlands or plow up their prairie. It's all about economics. And so what I think we have to realize is that we can't end up being in a global economy. We're in a global environment. And this is what the press, I wish they would cover this, and maybe you don't agree with me, but I think this is the central fact. If the world, the UN, we all talk about all the great work the UN does. If the world and the G7's meeting this weekend in Europe, if they said this is really the destruction of the Amazon is going to affect mankind, it is going to impact the quality of life of the world. It's up to the world's countries then to make sure that doesn't happen and not to tell Brazil it can't burn its Amazon because the people of Brazil have no economic choice. There are more and more people all the time. There's more and more economic pressure to feed people. There's more and more need for grain around the world. So Brazil is going to keep cutting the Amazon down because it has an economic incentive to do so. Until we change the entire equation around and say, here's the economic incentive not to tear the Amazon, not to burn the Amazon down. Here's the economic incentive not to drain and plow up what's left of the North American prairies. These things are going to continue. We're going to continue to see the erosion of the world's natural resource areas, not because people want to destroy them, but because people are destroying them to have a way of life. We had among the world's largest hardwood forests in America when we were settled, from basically St. Louis to the Gulf of Mexico along the Mississippi alluvial plain was a hardwood forest of tens of millions of acres, a fantastic value. It, too, was a great carbon sequesterer. We have cleared 99% of that forest. There's almost nothing left, and it provides some of the world's most fertile farmland. That's what Brazil is doing with the Amazon, only we know a lot today that we didn't know in the 1880s, 1890s, and in fact, one of the largest clearing decades in history in America was the 1960s and 70s. We knew something by then, but we didn't stop it. So here we are in 2020. We understand the importance of the Amazon to the world. We understand the importance of the North American prairies to the world, but we don't do anything to stop their destruction because we're not providing economic reasons to keep them. Instead, we just try to provide regulatory reasons, and in case of Brazil, tell them they can't do it. That's not going to change the game. This is a international environmental disaster that's occurring in Brazil, and it's all based around economics. If the money is there for the Amazon from the nations of the world, there won't be another fire set in the Amazon. It's not there, and that is what I don't think the media reports, and that is the absolute core foundation of the problem. It's about economics. It's very simple. Thank you for listening this morning. I hope you've enjoyed the show. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.